So I'll just talk, and anybody who wants to listen can listen, and anybody who wants to keep talking can keep talking. So one of the things that is going to change Mormonism in a fundamental way is the internet. We all understand that. And we're going to talk a little bit now about how complexity theory influences information networks and how that ties into the internet and the way Mormon communication systems work. So what we have here is a diagram that shows two different types of communication systems. Do we have that? Is that pointer still here? Actually, if somebody could figure out how to turn off the lights up here, that would be helpful too. Thanks. So this system here shows what would be a very primitive human communication system, where you've got a number of small groups that are not connected by communication links. And the next step would be the formation of links between the systems, but very few links. And what that means is that it would take a long time for information to flow from one part of the system to another. And if you graph the Mormon communication system, what you would see is something that looks like this, with a hub right in the middle and a huge number of links into the central hub. So relatively little communication between groups, wards or stakes or whatever, and a huge amount of information flowing through a central hub that is controlled by the organization that controls the system as a whole. This is what's called a friendship network, and this is similar to how things work in real life. You'll have groups of friends with links between the groups, sometimes a few more random links, and so there's a cluster of communication systems with a little bit of communication between them. This shows the evolution from an ordered system. So Mormonism is a relatively ordered system, not like this one. Mormonism would have that central hub, but you can go from ordered to less ordered to less ordered. It's a completely random chaotic. And the random chaotic is the most robust system. That means that there's a huge number of connections between different parts of the system. But if you were building a communication system, that would be a very expensive way to build it because you're using so much wire, so many links to get from part to part. Something in this area here is the most efficient because you establish a few long links between different parts of the system. And that allows information to flow more efficiently. It turns out that this is a random system. This is a system that describes the way yeast metabolizes. So this is a system that appears in just about every natural phenomenon that you can find, including the internet. The internet formed more or less like that. Now you see these little links here. These are the long links that go through the system, whereas this is much more random. Again, if this were Mormon, there'd be a huge black dot right here. Huge black dot that's controlling everything. This is a trade-off between this would be very robust. It would be impossible to destroy because there would be so many random links. This is a lot quicker to build because there are less long links, but it's still quite robust, quite strong. It's one of these things that nature is designed by trial and error. That's a picture of yeast metabolizing, which looks, see that on the right, we've got the internet here. And then here we've got yeast metabolizing. It's exactly the same pattern. Neural patterns, our brains work on this basis too. Virtually the same pattern in the brain. I must be missing some stuff here. I am. So this slide describes what happens when you start putting in random links. This line here shows the random links that you're putting in. This line here shows the average communication length. And what happens, you can see you're putting these links in at a fairly steady pace. Very little happens in terms of the average communication length until a critical point is reached and then it just plunges. And so in the Mormon case, what you've got is you start out with something that looks like that looks like this over here, very ordered, and suddenly you overlay this on it. That's what the internet does. And phase transitions, information flows, determine how cultures form and reform. And the information flows that the internet has caused. I think of YouTube. I don't know how many of you have followed the YouTube phenomenon. That's how kids communicate these days. Right? They're blogging. They're YouTubing. They're putting up massive amounts of information. This is something so big and developing so quickly that there's no way any institution is going to be able to control it. And it's facilitated by the internet, which has these long links going from one place to another. So here's a little story to illustrate how this happens. A friend of mine in just near Calgary told me this story a short time ago. He was in a Mormon bishopric, and he'd been a Sunstoner for quite a while, been reading stuff, and then developed some, you know, relatively apostate ideas, but was keeping his mouth shut. And he discovered Mormon bulletin boards a couple of years ago, and he got onto a place called The View from the Foyer and started reading. And he found an essay written by an angry person named Philo on that board, which was me. And the essay was about Mormon marriage and how the problems with Mormon marriage and how people tend to sell their presence in order to get things in the future. So it kind of kills the relationship in the present. And you're bargaining that to get these blessings that are going to come after death. And a number of ideas along those lines were played out in this characteristically lengthy and boring essay. But since he's a boring person, he read the whole thing. And he got to about 4 in the morning on a Sunday morning with bishopric meeting starting at 7. And cursing Philo, right, realizing that he was going to pay a serious price the next day because he spent all this time reading. So he gets up at 6, goes off to bishopric meeting, gets through his PEC and all that. And he was in charge that day conducting, and the guy who was supposed to teach the priesthood lesson didn't show. So he had to come up with a priesthood lesson. The only thing he could think to talk about was Mormon marriage. So he gets up and says, hey, we're going to have a... Oh, this is working. Yes, ma'am. He gets up and he starts talking about, you know, the problems with bargaining the present for the future and so on and so forth. And one of the old gentlemen, this is a combined elders quorum high priest thing, and one of the older gentlemen puts up his hand and he says, brother, where are you getting this stuff? These sound like really crazy ideas. And he says, well, the former bishop wrote this material, and, you know, I think it's worth discussing. And so the discussion proceeded and became very enthusiastic. He said it was the best discussion they had in that priesthood group for years. People are coming up and patting him on the back after and saying they want to follow this up next week and so on and so forth. So that's the illustration of a long link, right? A rank apostate spilling out his bile on the internet, right? A Mormon bishopric member with a liberal bent sees it, repackages it just a little, and spikes it straight into the middle of a Mormon congregation. Now, that is happening everywhere. A friend of mine just moved to Japan to get away from Mormonism. Faithful man. Wife is completely faithful. Kids are in their teens. He applied for a transfer to Japan to try and get into an environment where the church was less influential in his life. Hasn't had a temple recommend for years. Gets into his ward in Japan, and his bishop, a young man about 35 years old, very naive, says, well, let's call you to the young men's secretary position. He hasn't had a temple recommend, hasn't had a calling for years. And he says, well, he'd accept that because he wanted to maybe hang out with his boys. And so the bishop says, well, we need to get you a temple recommend. At that point, he tells him the whole story. He doesn't believe, he's not going to pay tithing, et cetera, et cetera. And the bishop says, listens to all of this and says, well, wouldn't it help out your marriage if you had a temple recommend? Well, this is a new thought. He says, well, you know, it might be. He says, I'm not going to the temple. He said, I couldn't stand it when I had a recommend. I'd sit out in the garden and meditate while my wife went through. The bishop nods and says, well, but wouldn't it help out your marriage? Your wife is still very committed to this. And he says, well, I suppose so. Bishop writes him out a recommend. Hands him the recommend. So things are changing. There's a trend that the academics are studying called the evaporation of belief, where across the Christian landscape, people are opting toward behavior as the important standard.
I heard another story earlier today that I won't repeat that runs along those lines as well, where instead of requiring that you answer the right questions, the belief questions in the temple recommend interview, a bishop and a stake president here in North America just ask the behavior questions. Do you behave properly? Right? That's the way things are going. That's how a lot of this conflict between the religious groups, and I believe in the Muslim world eventually as well, will be resolved. The Jews figured this out a long time ago, right? Belief has not been important in the Jewish culture for a long time. And that's why. It's behavior. It's what, how you believe and behave that's important. I'm familiar with a group of Jewish congregations, 40 of them, who are overtly atheist. But they believe that it's important to maintain their culture. They love their community. They want to see the world through a meta-narrative of science and their cultural tradition. And so they congregate on that basis. Another interesting point, ant colonies. Ant colonies have a lifespan of about 15 years. When members of a foraging ant colony run into each other out foraging, if the colony is young, there will be aggression and violence between the members of the two foraging colonies. The younger, adolescent, if you will, ant colonies are reckless, erratic, and tend to violence. Toward the end of their lives, the ant colonies become more passive. And if they're out foraging and they run into somebody, they'll just sort of tip their hat, give them a salute, and they both go their separate ways. Now, religious organisms have much longer lifespans, but they engage in the same behavior. Young religious organizations, Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, young Earth creationists, a reinvented brand of Christianity, are aggressive and violent and erratic. The older traditions, Catholics are not old relative to Jews, but it's the old traditions that have been bumping into each other for a long time. The Muslims are still quite violent. Those parts of the Muslim faith that have been isolated and have not matured in their interaction with other cultures are still very violent. But as time passes, we can expect the evaporation of creed that's part of this manifestation. People are saying, you know what, the beliefs are just not that important. Let's get along. We need to get along in order to make this work. And so that these systems that appear in the biological world, I think in provide increasingly persuasive explanations for what we see in sociology. Now, we're going to talk about attractor basins a little bit. Attractor basins, if you recall, are these valleys up here. Now, some attractor basins are really steep, like that. Others are very shallow, more like that. So the question is, what causes, from a sociological perspective, what causes a really steep attractor basin, and what causes a shallow attractor basin? Now, when I was talking about the ants a moment ago, the young aggressive ant colonies, that you would describe that as a relatively deep attractor basin, right? The behavior is aggressive. The borders are defended vigorously. The more mature tend to be more shallow, not as much aggression, not as much clear definitions of territory. The young aggressive ones will usually push out the older mature ones, simply because the older folks are just not prepared to fight quite as much. But there's a bunch of very interesting factors, I think, that go into this, what makes for deep and what makes for shallow. So genes and history, and I'm talking from a personal point of view now. So the best way to think about these attractor basins is to think of one rider on one elephant in one basin. Because the Mormon attractor basin is not one, right? This is my interaction with my Mormon faith. It's my attractor basin that collapsed. Didn't collapse for a lot of other people. And the reason it works that way is because this is dependent on perception. Information flows are very important because cultural attractor basins are formed really only by two things, perception and the importance of relationships. We're highly influenced by the closest relationships that we have, and that largely determines the way we perceive what's going on around us. Monism versus pluralism. If I perceive that there's only one true way to do things, that's a deep base, right? If Pluralism says, hey, you know, there's lots of ways to do this. Shallow basin. Again, think of mature and immature cultures. Mature cultures tend to be pluralistic. A harsh environment creates a steep attractor basin. Now, why is that? Just think about that. If you're in a harsh environment, how important is it that everybody be coordinated and do the thing right? The military. How important is it that people behave in order in the military? Hinduism. The oldest, the most crowded culture on earth. How important is it that people perform their role in that society instead of stepping out of bounds? There is an African Bushman initiation rite that Joseph Campbell describes that illustrates this. In that society, the initiation rite for the teenage kids works like this for the teenage males. You take all the little kid, the teenage males that are being initiated out into the bush with the men. So the men have the masks and the paint, and the men are dancing around a fire, performing their rituals. The boys are put behind a bush, and the boys are told that what is going on by the fire is sacred, and they must not look. And then the men go off and start whooping and dancing, right? Now, what's your average boy going to do? I mean, that's a tough test for an average 13-year-old kid. Well, the men leave a guy behind to watch. The first kid that looks is grabbed, taken to the fire, killed, and eaten. Now, what sort of message does that send? Right? Is this a strict society, or is this a... How deep is this attractor basin, right? Like that story characterizes an entire social matrix. These people live out in the African bush. Resources are very scarce. They're scratching out a living. It's very important that people do their job in order for the group to survive. Harsh environments create that kind of culture. What kind of environment did the Hebrews come out of? A harsh environment. What did Brigham Young do to the Mormons? This is one hell of a harsh environment. I was thinking about that as I drove down from Park City yesterday, thinking, what must my ancestors have thought as they were, and little did they know that this is some of the research that my father, of all people, has done, that the Mormon Church carefully considered Oregon and Vancouver Island as places to settle. The driver for making the decision to stay here was that they wanted complete isolation. And the anthropologist will tell you that a religion does not get off the ground until it's had an opportunity to function in a monopoly environment for a significant period of time, where it can create its own culture. And we're going to talk in a minute about why that is such an important thing for attractor bases. The movie Water, by the way, I would recommend highly. It's about the Hindu caste system and the way widows are treated within the Hindu caste system. A brilliant, touching movie. Well, and in Mormonism, right now, the real environment's not that tough, but what about this battle against evil, right? We've got a battle against evil going on. They're going to marry gay people. They might bring back polygamy. You've got, you know, evil and communism and, you know, these terrible, you go from one generation to the other. There's always a huge ideological boogeyman that the Mormon leaders are trumpeting. And using that to whip up the masses and to say, we are at war. You can't flinch. You can't blink. You can't be liberal because your children are going to go to hell, which was Elder Holland's beautiful talk that motivated me to write my first significant piece of anti-Mormon literature a few years ago. Attachment theory, another great line of social science research that starts out with how children bond to parents. There are some attachments that are good and others that are bad. Secure attachments are the ones that create a child where the child is confident in the absence of his parents because the parent is available when required. The child develops confidence in his environment because the attachment to the parent is secure. Insecure attachments are where and there's more to it than this, but this is just in a nutshell. Insecure attachments are where the parent is absent or arbitrary or conditional in a big way. The child becomes nervous and anxious and becomes overly dependent on the presence of the parent. Well, we have attachments to institutions as well. There's a great book written by a guy named Lee Kirkpatrick on this topic. And the attachment to a religious institution can create that same instability where we need the influence of the institution. That creates a deep attractivism. Right? When we try to leave, we feel threatened because without the influence of the institution, we wonder whether we can survive. And the institutions can build that insecurity into us, and they do it not purposefully. Like Spencer Kimball and Gordon Hinckley and people like that, they don't sit around thinking, well, how can we really screw these people up, right? How can we make them so insecure that they can't survive outside? Well, but there's a collective unconscious mind in every organization. The organization is trying to survive. If you look at the FLDS case that we heard outlined so nicely here, it's the same thing but worse, right? They cripple those kids so that they are programmed to fail if they go out into the big bad world. Mormonism does the same thing. It's just not as extreme. And this is what we should expect from organizations. Once we understand that, we can accept it. We can deal with these people the way we deal with snakes. We don't pick up snakes and play with them, right? But we understand what they can do. We understand the circumstances in which they do it, and we govern ourselves accordingly. Social capital. This is a brilliant concept. A guy named Larry Iannacone is an economist, and he's applying rational choice theory from economics to the study of religion. And one of his ideas, he's got a lot of really good ideas, but one of them works like this. Once an organization gets sufficiently complex, then you have to invest a lot of time and effort just to get along in the organization. This links to the idea that that religions don't prosper long term unless they've had an opportunity to exist in a monopoly state where they can develop their own idiosyncratic ways of doing things. So if you become a Mormon, you've got to learn these rituals, you've got to learn these hymns. There's a whole way of being Mormon that we who have been Mormon don't even know because that's the way we were raised. Then there's status that you get by serving in callings. There's a whole language. Mormons speak a language that is, it's a subcategory of English because there's so much terminology. Those are all signs of a very robust culture. So I'm 45 years old. I spent my whole life, basically, getting social capital. All of this stuff, these skills, I know more about scouts than you can imagine. And I've got scouting coming out of my ears. Mormon scouting, which is different than regular scouting. I know all kinds of stuff. I can quote most of the temple ceremony. Massive amounts of my brain have been absorbed over the period of time that I was Mormon in collecting social capital, assets that are very valuable to me within the Mormon community. And absolutely worthless outside. In fact, they're a liability outside in many ways. So once you've invested yourself so heavily in this social capital, that creates a barrier to leaving. You're going to have to go start over. You're nobody. You've got a whole identity, this meta-narrative concept again. Your meta-narrative revolves around these assets. These cultural assets that you have paid dearly for. And the greater that social capital, the less likely it is that your mind is going to allow you to see what's going on. Back to our rider and our elephant. That elephant is not going to let you just go do any crazy shit you want, right? That elephant is very concerned about survival. And it will screen information. There's lots of good psychological studies that show how that works. How you can lay the information right on the table and people do not see it. They've even studied the brain itself to see what's going on. The information does not register in the brain. The neural patterns that should be there are not there, right? The elephant is just shutting that down. Like, it's not like the brain is seeing it and saying, we won't look at that. It does not register information that should register, that does register in other contexts. When you set someone up against one of these social problems, the information does not even register at the neural level in the brain. That's your elephant. Your elephant's taking care of you. Back in the day, when our biology was evolving, what would happen if you got kicked out of your social group, by the way? This is a small herd. You're dead. What happens if you're stupid enough to do something that would break up your social group? Everybody's dead, right? Your whole biology is built to avoid that, right? And we're now in a circumstance, in an environment that is radically different from the environment in which our biology developed. It doesn't just shut off. It can't shut off. The more conscious we become of how it works, the better we're able to sort of reinterpret these signals that we get. Like right now when I'm at work, this reading I've done about Mormonism has been profoundly helpful for what I do when I'm helping people negotiate transactions. I'm basically an M&A lawyer. I do income tax work, but most of it in a mergers and acquisitions context where there's a lot of negotiation involved, a lot of emotion, and a lot of money involved. And when I hear, you know, fear and desire, that you can explain most of our mistakes on the basis of too much fear or too much desire for something. And those bells are just ringing in my head all day long as I watch people deal with each other and you know, get ready to make profoundly silly decisions in a commercial context. It's all the same stuff. It all works the same way. Okay, here's Deanna Coney. And this, unfortunately, is not working the way it should. But this is utility here. This is how useful we think something is. These are value systems. This curve here is the Mormon value system. This curve here is the secular value system. So this is plotting the way a guy like me would be living his life, right? So I'm a Mormon, which means this is my ideal value system, but I'm living in a secular culture that has this value system, different. So the rational thing to do, what the economists would predict, is I kind of nestle in or out right here. I maximize the utility I get from both behaviors. So I'm not, if I was full-on Mormon, I'd be up here. That's the way I was, by the way. I was full-on Mormon. If I was full-on secular, I'd be here. Well, that's actually not that big a distance. And I can sort of satisfy most of the requirements of both communities. That's a shallow attractor basin, right? Not that hard to get out of, not that hard to get into. And for a liberal Mormon living in, I don't know, California or someplace like that, maybe that's the way it works. Attaboy, Jaron. Okay, what about this? Here's your ideal Mormon behavior. And the height of the curve, by the way, is the perceived utility. Let's go back to that other one just for a sec. Whoops, I'm going the wrong way. Okay, perceived utility. The Mormon guy is saying, yeah, you know, we got something going here. But, you know, those, my Jewish friends, the liberal Jewish atheist guys, you know, that's pretty cool too. And those liberal Methodists, you know, that, you know, all of these things, you know, they're sort of in the same ballpark. And that's the way most of liberal Christianity perceives itself these days. But what about somebody in this situation? Okay. The value systems are way apart. There is no overlap, right? This is kind of like the FLDS. Or maybe Mormonism when they moved to Utah, saying, look, we want no part of you, right? You secular, terrible people. We are our own people. And by the way, we are way better than you. Make no mistake. This is a really steep attractor base. Well, you know, yeah, no, you're right. Now, where was Rove from? He's not Mormon, but okay. What happens when we move these? So, think about Mormonism in the early 1900s, late 1800s in Utah, right? Things are now starting to move a little bit closer together. You've got Mormons, non-Mormons coming into Utah in huge numbers, and you're getting some interaction, right? But how many people are going to be able to do that? Nobody's going to be happy. The secular people are going to think you're a goof. The religious people are going to think you're unfaithful. That's tough, right? Not very much room for compromise there. Now how about this one? This is an interesting one. And I'm freely interpreting Larry Iannacone here. He didn't quite get around to this, but I think he'd agree with me. So what does this say? Here's the secular curve. Here's the Mormon curve. But the perceived value, this is inside my head, remember. The perceived value is not that different. What kind of a guy would be in that position? How about a Mormon who's faking it? A Jack Mormon, he's come over here, right? He's down in here somewhere. But I know a lot of people. One of my buddies said to me, said, Bob, I took the blue pill. Is that the right pill? From the Matrix? I get the colors mixed up. Yeah, he said, Bob, I've taken the blue pill. Now, he's also the guy that when people come to him, because we're partners, he's really funny. We were university roommates. He's a great guy. When I sent out this little letter that caused quite a stir in our community, and because people were, the rumor was out that I was fornicating with my secretary at work, and I decided, because I had stopped going to church, the rumor was he's fornicating with his assistant, and he's become addicted to pornography on the internet. So I thought I'd better send out, a clarifying note to some of my friends. And then I went out of town on a business trip. When I got back a week later, he walked into my office and he said, Bob, the next time you send out a press release, let me know. He said, because I'm leaving town too. He said, I spent the whole frickin' week answering phone calls about you and your dumbass religious stuff. Like he said, I've taken the blue pill. He said, by the way, here's what I tell people. When they come to me and they ask about this, they're concerned about you and everything, and they want to know if you've gone crazy and what you're doing. I say, look, I don't know anybody who's tried harder than Bob to understand this stuff. He said, I couldn't even imagine trying as hard as Bob has tried to understand this stuff. And I happen to think he's wrong. If God has any justice, he's going to treat Bob kindly. Because Bob has tried just so hard. So you know, cut him a break. He's crazy. Let's just, you know. But he's tried so hard. Just cut him some slack. And no, he's not fornicating. And yes, he seems happier, more relaxed, more fun than I've ever seen him in the 25 years that I've known him. But he's crazy, and just leave him alone. So that's the way he deals with that. So he is here. He perceives no difference, or very little difference, between the Mormon way and the other way. The values are, you know, very divergent. He's living around here. Actually, he's living right around here, but he's faking it right around here. And he lives with levels of cognitive dissonance that would kill me. I just couldn't do that. And I love that man. He and I are very close. I'm not being critical of him. I'm just saying I am not capable of doing what he's doing. I'd just be guessing. I would. Yeah. Well, I was told by a friend who delivered a letter that I wrote to Thomas Monson, told me that Monson read the letter as she sat there and watched him, and she asked him about the letter. It was basically the same letter that I sent to Jeffrey Holland. And after reading the letter, Monson said, I feel very sorry for this man. He's missing the big picture. He's, you know, all these little issues that he's concerned about. He's missing the eternities. We're back to the meta-narrative again. If you really believe in the celestial kingdom, I am missing the big issue. If you really believe that it's not a good idea to sell your entire life for a speculative, you know, after-death good, then I'm onto something. Now, here's another, it's like we're running out of time here. Here's another chart, and I think this one's really interesting. So how would you characterize this? You've got perceived utility up here, but how much difference is there between these two systems, really? Not much, right? So that means that this huge differential between perceived utility is all based on hot air, kind of like an internet stock a few years ago. So if the information environment changes, what's going to happen to that poor sucker up there? Move along the value axis? Oh, I think, yeah, the value axis shifts, and that's the meta-narrative thing. The meta-narrative determines this. That's the guy that I was trying to describe before. The guy who's, you know, he's pretending to be in one, and in fact he's more in the other, and it's a double-minded approach from my perspective that would cause me to become dishonest both with myself and with other people. But this I think is the current church environment, largely, right here. Not much difference in behavior, really. Huge perceived difference in terms of value, based wholly on information. And so as the information network changes, going back to what we were talking about before, and particularly as young people get access to this information, as young people blog and as they YouTube and as they communicate with each other on email lists or whatever they do, that is going to change. The people of my generation, of our generation here, speaking for the older folks, it's highly improbable that very many of us are going to change. You know, for whatever, you know, whatever weirdness that caused me to change, you know, I don't know, I'm grateful for it. But the game is being played with the teenagers and the 20-somethings. Yes. Yeah. I agree completely with that, and there's a good answer for it. That the answer, get a book called The Battle for God by Karen Armstrong, and she explains how we're in this pitched battle with kinds of truth pitted against each other, and the secular world is becoming increasingly more powerful in its arguments. The information that is circulating is scaring the daylights out of people. That's basically it. So if you're a person whose Mormon faith is cracking because of the secular arguments, the FLDS have the better theological argument. There's absolutely no question about that. If you really believe the doctrine, so you've been put into a box. You're scared to death by this chaos. Remember, we're small herd animals, right? Leaving your herd is death, or it feels like it's going to be death. And so you're being presented with two choices. Go over to this other herd that thinks the way you do, and it looks like they're right. The more you learn about your own history and your own theology, the more it looks like those weirdos down in Colorado City are right. Right? So there's choice one. Choice two, you just blast off into the wild blue yonder. Who knows? You might become an atheist. Yeah. You know, just horror of all horrors. The worst epithet that can be thrown at a potential ex-Mormon is atheist, right? So Karen Armstrong plays that out very nicely, how the increasing tide of secular knowledge washing throughout the world in the Muslim, the Jewish, and the Christian world has increased the hold of fundamentalists. Now, I think that this is a generational thing that's going to run out of steam because the young people are coming up in a different environment. But for us old people, us old bent over trees, right? Hard for us to change. That looks like an attractive choice if you don't have enough information, in my opinion. That's a good point. And I shaved what was left off because I started to look really goofy. Goofier, I should say. So we've been through this. I want to end with one little story that I think is quite helpful. I like this one. Let's go back to that. Religion doesn't have a good batting average when it steps up to the plate while science is pitching. So why not make that part of your religion? No. If we're wrong, that's the way God wanted it. Truth is revealed line upon line, precept upon precept. Well, here's what happens then. You just keep walking down the path, knocking out what doesn't work, forgetting about it because line upon line doesn't work real well in practice, right? So let's just ditch this stuff, bury it, and forget about it. John Haidt, The Happiness Hypothesis. Here's why you should put science first. These books are brilliant books. I mean, they will tell you helpful things about how to live, how to make a better marriage. I was going to run through a bunch of them, but we don't have time. Here's one I will run through, though. This one's really good. This is from John Haight, The Happiness Hypothesis. He says there's two kinds of love. This is 6 months. This is romantic love. Boom. Because that's hormonal, right? And John Haight says that anyone who makes a marriage decision in that space, he said there should be laws to prohibit that for the same reason that there are laws to prohibit drunk driving. It's the same problem. How many Mormons here decided to get married while they were in that hormonal cascade? That's the way it's designed, right? You can't have sex until you get married. Well, surprisingly, people have revelations to get married right after they get home from their missions, and these sweet young girls have been programmed to think that the young man who's thinking with his little head instead of his big head is getting a revelation. It's the stupidest thing you can imagine. Okay, here's companionate love, right? 6 months. There's not much difference between companionate love and romantic love at its depressed level after 6 months. But what about after 60 years? Right? Companionate love you earn. It's completely different from romantic love. Well, this here, right there, that was when the husband left Mormonism. A lot of stress around there, right? Maybe a separation. Felt pretty good when they got back together. I probably should have made that a little higher, actually. That probably went about up to there. Okay, well, so what kind of relationship do you want? Do you want to earn that companionate love over 30, 40, 50 years? Or maybe you prefer this. Some people do, right? So this is relationship number one, number two, number three, number four. Every time you get into a new relationship, guess what happens? The hormonal cascade all over again. And some people think after 2 or 3 or 6 months, something's happened. The magic is gone. This must not be my true love. Let's roll the dice again, right? And it just keeps going on and on and on. So this is the kind of stuff that there's a scientific basis for this. We can actually come to understand how things work. John Gottman on marriage. James Surowiecki on group decision making. Martin Seligman on the biology and psychology of happiness. And so on and so forth. This is the kind of stuff that I want to spend my life studying because it works. It really does work. Yes, Ted. Keep talking. The closer they are, the harder it is to deal with. I have a very hard time dealing with my parents and my siblings. It's just I still have a profoundly dysfunctional attachment to them, and it's very, very difficult for me to deal with them. And I hope that improves. I'm just going to tell one very quick story, and then we're done. So here's an exercise to do. If you want to find out about your meta-narrative, here's a way to do it. This scared the daylights out of me the first time I did it. You close your eyes. You can't do this here, probably. You imagine the phases of your life, childhood, adolescence, young adulthood, break it up any way you want, and think about a landscape or a path or a river. Choose a metaphor for your life and draw it out. No matter how bad an artist you are, get a piece of paper out and draw the map, and you will be amazed at what comes tumbling out. It scared me so badly I had to stop the first time I did this. So you might get images like this, right? This comes spontaneously. You quiet yourself and you just sort of let this come, and then maybe it's like this, maybe it's like this. Different periods of life. Maybe it's like this. Maybe it's a peaceful river. Maybe there's a huge panoramic view. Maybe you're in a tight little spot. Maybe it's like this. I've got one of those. Or maybe it's like this. That's me. That's what came out of me. As a Mormon, I walked a tightrope. There were a million things that could go wrong. If they didn't go wrong with me, they were going to go wrong with my kids. It was my job to save them, to prevent them from falling, to prevent me from falling. I was wound up so tight I was going to explode. And now it's like this. There's this huge process. I can't control this process, but I can understand the process. Maybe a storm is going to come up, knock me out of the air, and I'll be dead, right? I can't control that. But most of it, I can understand it, and I can go with it. And I can choose, to some extent, where I go. And the change between this and that is the most miraculous thing I have ever experienced. And back here we end. Thank you.